Hello, good morning, and welcome to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. Today on Line One, we are going to discuss the important but difficult topic of sexually transmitted infections, or STIs. The rates of STIs have been increasing in Alaska and nationally over the last 5 years. This is particularly true of syphilis. Syphilis often has no symptoms, but can lead to serious health problems without treatment. It can also have a serious effect on an unborn child if you are pregnant. Other STIs include chlamydia, gonorrhea, herpes, HPV, and HIV/AIDS, among others. The bottom line is that STIs are common and all are preventable. Today, I am pleased to be joined by two wonderful guests. Dr. Liz Olson is a family practice doctor and staff physician for the State of Alaska Section of Epidemiology and the acting program manager, for the HIV and STD program. James Hoagland is director of client resources and Southeast programs for the Alaska 4As. You can also be a part of our conversation. If you have a question or a comment, call us toll-free statewide at 888-353-5752. 888-353-5752. In Anchorage at 907-550-8433. 907-550-8433. Or you can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. I'd like to start by introducing Dr. Elizabeth Olson. Thank you for being on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
I wanted to give you an opportunity to introduce yourself to our listeners and tell us a little bit about yourself and your practice and what your role is now.
Sure. So I'm Liz Olson. I'm a family physician. I've lived in Anchorage for a long time and did my training here as well. And have a particular interest in preventing sexually transmitted diseases and other things that can affect people's lives and can also be easily treated. Here at the state with the Division of Public Health, I work with the section of epidemiology, and the main thing that we do here is track and try to prevent sexually transmitted infections and HIV, and then try to connect people to treatment. So a big part of that is talking about how to protect yourself from these infections, and then how to get testing, and then how to get treatment. So that's kind of the overview of what we do here.
Great. Well, thank you for being here today. We also have James Hoagland, I believe, has joined our program, and he is with the Alaska 4As. James, would you be able to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure thing. My name is James Hoagland, and I've been with the Alaskan AIDS Assistance Association, in other words, 4As, for about 10 years in different roles. I work out of the Juneau office. We have three offices around the state, headquartered here in Anchorage, but we also have a Juneau office and one in Wasilla for the Matsu Valley. I work with the program that serves clients living with HIV in the state and their families. And we also have several other programs at 4As that are focused on preventing the further spread of the virus, HIV. And really closely linked to that is work preventing and educating about STIs as well. We know that there is a pretty strong link between HIV and other STIs. In other words, folks living with HIV can be more susceptible to STIs if they're not undergoing treatment for their HIV. And there's just a general connection around sexual health and wellness that we approach all of our programs with here. So, while we are focused on HIV, we definitely include STI prevention and education in our work as well.
Excellent. Well, thank you. for being with us today again, James. Let's start by going over some definitions. I have heard, even through my opening and Dr. Olson, the use of both sexually transmitted diseases, STDs, as well as STIs. Let's define for our listeners what an STI is and if it's interchangeable as the phrase STD. So I'll start with you, Dr. Olson.
Sure. So I think while these terms are used interchangeably, I think it's most helpful to think of these as sexually transmitted infections. And the reason is that these are infectious diseases that are treatable. And so what we're talking about really when someone has an STI is that they have an infection, and that infection is something that we can treat the same way we would with another bacteria or another virus, with the treatment available for that specific infection. So I guess an STI is a sexually transmitted infection. So it's an infectious disease like a bacteria or a virus, and it can be spread through sexual contact.
Okay. So I think it's some of it is semantics. I mean, when I was going through medical school, it was always an STD. And I know that changed in the last 10 or 15 years to STIs. I guess disease maybe has more of a connotation of a longer lasting or something that doesn't go away, whereas an infection is the connotation that it's treatable and you can move on. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's helpful. You know, most STIs are treatable. Or all STIs are treatable, most are curable. So I think it is helpful to kind of think about it like that.
Yeah, James, what about you? Any thoughts on the just the definitions?
Sure, I definitely agree with Liz and her explanation of why we've moved as a community, as a field. The only thing I would add for us, we find that it really helps to decrease the stigma associated with having an STI. You know, a disease does imply that it's something that can't be treated or can't be cured. And just like Liz stated, most STIs, all STIs are treatable and most can be cured. So we work really hard to destigmatize these things because they're incredibly common, especially in Alaska. And there's no shame in contracting an STI. Most likely, most folks do have at least one STI in their lifetime. So this is not something that anybody should be ashamed of or afraid to get testing for or seek out treatment for. Because at the end of the day, they're routine, common health concerns that all of us have.
Sure. Just about when anything is surrounded by sex or sexually transmitted, it certainly takes on a different connotation, and there's some embarrassment around that. So hopefully we can start. I mean, you guys already do every day, but dispel. You know, we got to treat it as an infection, just like you would any other infection, like pneumonia. We need to be able to talk like adults and treat this. So in general, besides the obvious, how are these typically spread? Because, you know, some people may be concerned, oh, can I get it from a public bathroom, sitting on the toilet seat or doorknobs or swimming pools, hot tubs, all that sort of stuff. So is that something that happens, or is that an old wives' tale? Dr. Olson.
Yeah, so I think this is really helpful for everyone to understand. So sexually transmitted infections, and so this can include things that are more common, like chlamydia, gonorrhea, herpes. Herpes is, of course, the most common. Or things that have been less common in the past, like syphilis or HIV, which is also known as the human immunodeficiency virus. These can be spread through any type of sexual contact. There are also some that can be spread by kissing or skin-to-skin contact with sores. And so this is more specifically things like syphilis and herpes. For some of the STIs, for instance, human immunodeficiency virus, it really requires skin to skin or sexual contact or, you know, other exposure directly to blood to spread, meaning that, you know, for instance, you can't get HIV by shaking someone's hand or from a doorknob or from sharing laundry with someone or living in a house with them, things like that. So I hope that kind of starts us off.
Yeah, absolutely. James, anything to add with that? Like, you know, particularly you're with the HIV, of course, but anything else on that topic?
Sure. Sometimes when we talk about prevention broadly in the HIV world or even in STI world, we talk about how somebody without the infection can protect themselves from getting the infection, right? So that may be any type of latex barrier during sex, like a condom, for example, or other methods that someone may protect themselves from contracting the virus or the infection. But there's also one other way that significantly decreases HIV infections, and that is for folks who are living with HIV to be on treatment. And treatment for folks living with HIV is an antiretroviral medicine that's taken every day. There are even some long-acting injectable treatments these days. But overall, for the majority of people living with HIV, these medications work so well that they are able to suppress the virus in the system and make it impossible to pass on to another person. So this is a huge development that's happened in HIV in the last decade, the recognition that this is true. Scientifically, this is proven, and it is a huge reason why there's not more HIV infections today. So we try to always include that method of preventing HIV so that people, regardless of their HIV status, everybody is able to contribute to the effort of preventing the spread of the disease. And it recognizes just how much power someone living with the disease has themselves.
Great. Thank you, James, for that explanation. I want to give our listeners the call-in numbers. Again, if they have questions for our guests today, the number statewide is 888-353-5752 or in Anchorage, 907-550-8433 or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. So let's talk about who's at risk of contracting an STI. I know this is a broad topic, but certainly we'll start. How about we start with you, James? How do people get these infections? Who is most at risk of contracting them?
Sure. I think we do look at the method of transmission and who is at risk as separate questions. And I think Liz has started talking already about the methods of the transmission, which is a little tricky because different infections are transmitted differently. So it is important to look at the different ways that an infection can be spread. It's not the same for all STIs. Of course, we put them in the category of sexually transmitted. So yes, during sexual contact, transmission is possible for all STIs, but some are more easily transmissible than others. And it's important to understand the differences there. So all of that said, who's at risk is anyone who is sexually active, is at risk for an STI. There are things that amplify somebody's risk. Perhaps, you know, the more sex someone has, the more they're at risk, potentially. That could be one way to look at it. Things like having multiple partners, things like having sex while intoxicated or high on drugs is another way that raises the risk level of having sex in that kind of way. But we will also work really hard to destigmatize all forms of consensual adult healthy sexuality. So all of us have equal risk as far as the infections themselves are concerned. They don't care who or how they come into contact with a person, but it's less about someone's identity and more about their the behaviors that they're engaged in. All of them can be totally natural, healthy, very common behaviors that we have, but as you were speaking of at the top of the show, they're ones that have a lot of stigma potentially. People are embarrassed to talk about, or as a society or cultures, we don't talk about very openly. So too often we attach high risk or the label high risk to certain groups of people or identities that people have. And that's a really dangerous thing to do, not only because it's not accurate, and it also excludes a lot of other people who probably are at risk as well.
Sure, sure. Dr. Olson, I'm sure you have something to add here.
Sure. So sexually active people, men and women, are at risk for having sexually transmitted infections. And so this is the way I think about it, is this is especially anyone who has a new partner or who has multiple partners, or who has a partner who has multiple partners. We see sexually transmitted infections among sexually active people of all ages. So there's not necessarily an age group limit on who should get tested. It's more just about, you know, thinking about, again, new partners and multiple partners. The other thing that I would add is that sharing needles can transmit some of the infections we've been talking about. So that's another thing that can increase risk. But when I think about who should be tested for STIs, it's really more around sexually active people, especially if they have a new partner or have multiple partners.
Great. What about people that have barriers to care? Is that a risk factor?
So I think, you know, having a barrier to getting healthcare doesn't necessarily change somebody's likelihood of having a sexually transmitted infection. It just makes it more likely that they might not get tested or they might not get treated in a timely manner. And since, you know, all of these infections are treatable, I think the thing that's most important is people knowing how to access testing, being able to get to somewhere that offers testing or have it come to them, getting treatment if they're diagnosed with any one of these infections. And, you know, I think there's, for some people who have relationships with a healthcare provider, for instance, you have a regular doctor, this can be very straightforward. It can be something that, for instance, you get tested at your next checkup visit. For people who don't necessarily have a healthcare provider, I think that's where some of the low-cost and free testing available around Alaska really comes into play. Getting tested at, you know, a public health center or at the municipality of Anchorage Clinic downtown on L Street. Things like that can really help make testing more accessible and make treatment more accessible, especially for people who don't necessarily have a healthcare provider that they're seeing on a regular basis.
Absolutely. And we'll circle back to that towards the end, just about treatment locations or testing locations as well. I do want to take a quick break here. You are listening to Line One, your health connection. If you have a question or a comment for our guest today, call us statewide at 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752. Or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. Excuse me, that's 907-550-8433. After the short break, we'll continue our discussion on STIs with Dr. Liz Olson and James Hoagland. Welcome back to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. I'm joined today by Dr. Liz Olson with the State of Alaska Section of Epidemiology and the Acting Program Manager for the HIV and STD programs, as well as James Hoagland, who is Director of Client Resources and Southeast Programs for the Alaska 4As. Do you have a question about STIs? If you have a question or a comment, you can reach us toll-free statewide, 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752. Or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. 907-550-8433. Also, if you'd prefer email, you can email us at line1, that's L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at alaskapublic.org. Okay, Dr. Olson and James, I want to talk a little bit about prevention of STIs, or at least, you know, how you can reduce risk as well. Again, broad question here, but what are the ways that you're recommending to your patients to at least reduce their risk and prevent STIs if possible? So I'll start with Dr. Olson.
Thanks, Dr. Clark. So one of the things that I talk with my patients about is that one of the higher risk things is, for instance, having a new partner when you both haven't had testing yet, or having multiple partners. So thinking about, you know, getting tested with your partner, having conversations about, you know, have you been tested, can be very helpful to reduce risk of STIs. Many STIs can be prevented or at least reduced by using condoms or other barrier methods. And, you know, because there are certain STIs like syphilis that can be still transmitted through, for instance, an open sore when even when condoms are used correctly every time, testing remains very important for those. Condoms are excellent for protecting against some other STIs that are spread primarily through body fluids. But I think in general, getting tested at the beginning of any new partnership is a really good idea.
Excellent. James, anything to add to that?
Yeah. In my first role with 4A's, I did a lot of education around HIV prevention. And something I always shared in my classes was the best tool for prevention is communication. Communication with your partner about your own status, what you know about your own status, if you've been tested recently or not, and then opening up a conversation, asking them, you know, where are they at with their testing and knowledge of their own status. The other thing that really helps to control the spread of STIs and reduce the burden of having one is knowing where your testing resources are and knowing what kind of treatment would be available if you were to contract an STI. So I find that information, of course, is one of the best tools when you're armed with information and education about this subject, then you are much better off when you're trying to protect yourself and your partners from STIs.
Great. We kind of talked before a little bit about how having one STI may put you at risk of having others. And I had a follow-up question. We'll start with James here. For patients with HIV and AIDS, you had mentioned that they are at higher risk of potentially contracting another STI. And I wanted to know if that was because their immune system was weakened and more susceptible, or if it was the behaviors instead of the health, and if you had any ideas about that.
Sure. It is definitely based on the health of that person, the health of their immune system. So if it's someone who maybe they don't know their HIV status and they are they do have HIV, that virus is probably pretty active in their system. It's probably at a high level of the viruses in their system. And so it's causing a lot of damage to the immune system. And that makes that person more susceptible to all sorts of infections, things that are respiratory, but also things like sexually transmitted infections. And the other thing is that if somebody does have a sexually transmitted infection, the infection may be in their genitals. And so they're, at that point, their genitals are a location that's more susceptible to contracting another one, because that particular area of the body is currently battling the another infection. So sometimes we look at it like a site specific risk or susceptibility to transmission.
Great. And Dr. Olson, just to phrase the question to you again, does one STI put you at risk of having others?
So yes, it does. Anyone who has one STI should be tested for all STIs. So I think it's important to just think about, for instance, if you're exposed to someone else's, the body fluids that can carry STIs, there's the potential for more than one to be carried at the same time. I think also, anybody who's had a sexually transmitted infection recently tends to be at risk of getting another STI in the near future. And a lot of this is just, again, because of the nature of having a new partner where you haven't both been tested yet, having multiple partners. So people who have had an STI in the last year or so should be tested regularly, for instance, every 3 to 6 months. And I think the thing that I always pair with that when I'm talking with patients is that STIs are treatable, most are curable. So it is important to get tested. And if one of these infections is found, to get treated right away.
Great. Great. So I do want to move into syphilis, because that's a big part of our discussion today as what's going on in Alaska. But we do have an email about herpes, and I wanted to pose this to Dr. Olson. Is there any progress towards a vaccine for herpes?
So the NIH has some ongoing work around this. So that's the National Institutes of Health. And they released a strategic plan for herpes virus research, which does include research towards a vaccine. That was last year. I haven't heard of new developments or clinical trials or things rolling out. I think it's a very important space to watch. Herpes is a very, very common infection. And, it does tend to, it can be quite painful. Some people have no symptoms at all, but it can be quite painful for some people. And the treatments available are very helpful, but not curative right now. So I think this is such an important part such an important field of research. I haven't seen a lot of, near-term progress towards a vaccine that I've heard of.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, the vaccine for HPV is out, and that's been quite effective in prevention, at least when it's given early in life, right?
Yes. So the vaccine for human papillomavirus, HPV, is really an incredible achievement, I think. So this is a virus, this is a vaccine that teenagers can get. So let's see, I think I got my first shot when I was 14. Now it's just a 2 or 3 dose series, but it actually protects against a virus that causes cervical cancer. And not only that, the virus causes some other cancers too. It's been linked to throat cancer and some other kinds of cancers. And the way it's played out is that it's been very, very effective. There's a recent study from Scotland done where they looked at women who had received this vaccine early in life, when they were still adolescents, and they didn't have a single case of cervical cancer, which I should add is a pretty common cancer. They didn't have a single case of cervical cancer in women who had been fully vaccinated when they were adolescents. So that really struck me. I think it's such a helpful thing to have, done, especially while people are, as you said, early in life, because of course it works if you get it before you're exposed to the virus. So I think that is a huge advancement, and I hope we start to see other vaccines that work as well for similar viruses.
Yeah, it's truly, truly amazing. So just to recap on that for our listeners who are younger or may have younger children or grandchildren, The HPV vaccine is typically given to girls. And what's the timing on that? Is it puberty or it's before sexual activity?
So I want to clarify one thing.
Mm-hmm.
So boys and girls are eligible for the HPV vaccine, and that is because both boys and girls are potentially at risk for cancer related to human papillomavirus. So there's a couple parts of that. One is that, transmission also involves men often. And even though men aren't at risk for, people who don't have a cervix aren't at risk for cervical cancer, this virus is linked with other types of cancer as well. And so it may have efficacy protecting against throat cancer later in life or other things like that. So I think it is important to think about this not necessarily just in girls, but in adolescents. So vaccines work best before exposure to a virus. And so I think that's why it's really important to have the HPV vaccine completed, early in adolescence, ideally before anybody's had exposure to this sexually transmitted infection. On the vaccine schedule, I think there's a note that you can discuss giving it as early as 9. So some people do go ahead and give it at age 9 or 10, just to kind of get it out of the way. Some people wait until it's until it's on the schedule right at 11. But because it's safe at any of those ages, I think it's fine to start at the time that it's, most convenient for the family.
Great, great. No, that's great information, and thank you for that clarification. Okay, let's get into syphilis a little bit. We're going to start just by defining it, what syphilis is, and we'll start again with Dr. Olson.
Sure. So syphilis is a bacterial infection. It is transmitted by sexual contact primarily. Syphilis used to be pretty uncommon here in Alaska, but it's becoming a little bit more common. So because there's an epidemic nationally, there's also an epidemic here in Alaska. And so we're seeing more and more. Syphilis can have no symptoms, but it can also have fairly serious symptoms and serious health consequences. So this is something that we're trying to really encourage people to know about syphilis, know that it's a STI, know that it's treatable, it's curable, but often it does require a test to know whether you have it, and then we can get treatment.
Sure. Sure. So let's talk a little bit about, James, let me ask you, is this something that you are seeing in more prevalence in your patient population?
Sure. That's a great question. I think that we are seeing a sort of parallel to the state broadly. We're seeing an increase of infections. There is a connection somewhat between the susceptibility, again, of contracting another STI if you already have one STI. So often, if somebody has syphilis and it's not being treated, and say they have an open sore, that can be an entry point for other infections, including HIV. And so sometimes we will meet new clients who are newly diagnosed with HIV and they've been diagnosed with an STI at the same time, an additional one. And so sometimes there is a correlation that we see. Generally, we are aware that there's more syphilis in the community. And so, like everybody else, we're aware of that and are educating about that. It also does impact, sometimes it impacts the treatment that folks living with HIV take and what kind of treatment of the other STI they're best suited for to avoid drug-drug interactions. So, yeah, it's definitely become more prevalent, and it's a topic that we used to primarily focus on chlamydia and gonorrhea as the most common in Alaska, but we've certainly added syphilis to that list now.
Yeah, so Dr. Olson, let's get into the numbers a little bit. I was reading the bulletin last night that you guys put out, the state puts out, kind of looking at the numbers and how they've increased over the last 5 years, and the breakdown, sort of the epidemiology of it. Can you explain to our listeners, like, when you say that there is a syphilis epidemic, I mean, what is it, what exactly does that mean? What are the numbers?
Right. So we've seen a very dramatic increase in syphilis in Alaska. So just for a sense of scale, we used to have maybe 20 cases of syphilis diagnosed in a typical year. Say in 2016, we had 20. And then by 2022, we had more than 400. We had 424 cases reported to us. So this is a 20-fold increase in just a handful of years, 6 years. And we continue to see much, much more syphilis than we've seen for many, many years here in Alaska. We'd really, I think we'd average 50 a year for decades, or fewer than 50 a year for decades. So what this really means is we have a high rate of syphilis now in many of our communities across the state. It's affecting people across all groups and communities, but most reported cases are really in urban areas. We have had cases in smaller communities, but particularly in, for instance, the Anchorage Matsu region, we are seeing a particularly high rate of cases. And just sort of as a historical note, before penicillin was available, syphilis used to be really common across the US, but because it can be cured with as little as one shot of penicillin if we catch it early, once treatment was available, many people were cured. And then for a long time, syphilis was very rare. So it's really just once we started seeing this huge epidemic nationally of syphilis, that we started seeing more and more cases here over the last 6 years, both in men and in women. So it's not really just one particular group anymore. It's more that many sexually active people, especially in urban areas here in Alaska, are at increased risk for syphilis.
That's very interesting. I wonder your thoughts on why that's occurring now.
Well, I think Alaska has had very high rates of sexually transmitted infections for a long time. And so for a while, we had the number one rate for chlamydia in the nation compared to all other states. We're still number three. We're behind only Louisiana and Mississippi, looking at the last federal data for chlamydia rates. So what I take from that is that the opportunities for transmission are there, meaning that people here in Alaska have had higher rates of sexually transmitted infections. And when we started seeing more and more syphilis in the lower 48 nationally, there wasn't anything necessarily stopping syphilis from becoming a problem up here. And so I think what's really key now is just a little bit more education around that we are seeing this increase, but also some education around how to protect yourself and get tested and treated for gonorrhea and chlamydia, which are also easily curable infections. We know that we have had, a pretty serious problem with gonorrhea and chlamydia with those very, very high rates for a long time. And I think syphilis is just another part of that. It's spread in the same way, same risk factors. And I think we can take a very similar approach of just helping people connect with regular testing, understand the risk factors, who should be tested, and then just know that it's curable and it's something that we can fix.
Yes, excellent. That's a good explanation. We're going to take our second little mid-break here. You are listening to Line 1, your health connection. If you have a question or a comment for our guest today, call us statewide at 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752, or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433, 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. After the short break, we'll continue our discussion on STIs with Dr. Liz Olson and James Hoagland. Welcome back to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. I'm joined today by Dr. Liz Olson with the State of Alaska Section of Epidemiology and the Acting Program Manager for the HIV and STD Program, as well as James Hoagland, who is Director of Client Resources and Southeast Programs for the Alaska 4As. Do you have a question about STIs? If you have a question or a comment, call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752, in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Well, we have about 15 minutes left, and I do want to get to a few more items here before we finish up. Dr. Olson, let's kind of go through the different stages of syphilis pretty quickly here in terms of what primary, secondary, and the other phases are, what they mean, just to give our listeners a sense of you know, why treatment is so important.
Sure, thanks. And, you know, I think when I'm teaching residents, I often start out saying, you know, here are the signs and the symptoms to look for so you can know whether somebody has this illness. And with syphilis, I'm going to talk about some symptoms, but I want to preface this with that it can often have no symptoms. Symptoms can be unnoticeable, easily missed, and can look like very many other things. And so I think testing is really key to know whether somebody has syphilis. You can't necessarily tell just by looking for symptoms. But syphilis does go through stages. And so when people first get infected, they usually develop a sore during the first few weeks or months. The sore often doesn't hurt. It can go away on its own. And it can be somewhere that's very hard to see. So the infection remains even when there's no symptoms or it goes unnoticed or the sore fades. And so the infection remains unless it's fully treated at that time. Later, so the secondary stage of syphilis, people can get rashes like spots on the palms of their hands or the soles of their feet. They can have spots all over the body. Many other symptoms like fevers, chills, body aches. Some people can have syphilis and have no symptoms at all for a long time. And they can be very hard to recognize, look like many other things. They also can come and go, which is why getting tested is so important. Other things that people have sometimes with secondary syphilis are fever, muscle aches, sore throat, headache, hair loss, or just feeling tired. Syphilis will often, after the secondary stage, fade to no symptoms for a while. This is called a latent stage, meaning there's no symptoms, but the infection's still there. It can remain hidden for many years at this stage, but it can still be detected by a blood test and cured with penicillin. And then if left untreated, it can progress into a tertiary stage. So this can be years and years later and cause serious damage to internal organs or other things, can incur in people who've never noticed symptoms. So that's where testing is really key. Tertiary syphilis can cause problems moving arms and legs or other paralysis, numbness, blindness, heart disease. And again, the only way to know whether this is syphilis or something else is testing. Then I also wanted to talk about, you know, how syphilis can impact the brain, the spinal cord, or the nerves at any stage. So this can be right when syphilis is first acquired or after many, many years. But this is called neurosyphilis or brain syphilis. It can cause headache, paralysis, confusion, trouble with memory, trouble with focus. It can also affect the eyes, causing eye pain or redness, floaters, so floating spots in the vision, pain with light or sensitivity with light, blurry vision, loss of vision. It can also affect hearing and balance. by, you know, causing ringing and buzzing in ears, balance problems, dizziness, or vertigo. And I imagine that many people listening to this are thinking to themselves, wow, that sounds like many, many, many other things. And it absolutely does. So I think testing is really our key for diagnosing syphilis.
Yeah, it sounds like it has a course that can range anywhere from never knowing you have it to absolutely devastating consequences.
Yes.
And so again, if you're at risk, then testing really sounds like your best option.
Yes, I think that's absolutely key.
Before we finish the show, we're gonna ask you guys about testing and where to get it and the options. But I do think it's important that we also talk a little bit about pregnancy and mm-hmm. syphilis, because it's a huge, huge opportunity for treatment and testing. So, Dr. Olson, what are your what can syphilis be spread to a unborn child, and what are the consequences of that?
So syphilis can cause serious problems for the baby if syphilis is not adequately treated during pregnancy. The good news is the cure for syphilis, which is penicillin, is safe during pregnancy. So all of the things that, syphilis can cause during pregnancy, for instance, it can cause infant death or stillbirth. It can cause serious long-term health consequences. But this is preventable. So this is why we test for syphilis so often during pregnancy now. The nationwide standard is to get 3 tests for syphilis during pregnancy, one right at the beginning of prenatal care, another later on in pregnancy, the 3rd test right when the baby's born, to make sure that if a pregnant woman has syphilis, we find out and can treat it right away before it causes harm to the baby. But unfortunately, here in Alaska, we have seen a very sharp increase in syphilis affecting babies. We've gone from fewer than a case per year before 2018 to 12 in 2022. So this is preventable. And so it's very critical that as soon as, that pregnant women receive prenatal care, and part of prenatal care is testing for syphilis so that the infection can be found and treated and cured before it passes to the baby.
Yeah, that sounds, again, so devastating and so preventable. And so if you are pregnant, then the standard would be at least 3 tests during pregnancy. And I guess one aspect of that is to ensure that mothers are actually getting prenatal care.
Exactly. And, I think this is a very standard part of prenatal care. We don't see big problems with people, not getting tested if they're regularly in prenatal care. But I think, making sure that people get into prenatal care, get those visits regularly, making sure that they're connecting with prenatal care early in pregnancy. And part of that is accessing pregnancy testing and other things to actually know pregnancy status. So I think that's something that many people will access either on their own, buying pregnancy tests over the counter, or through their regular healthcare provider's office. But there's also other resources in the community, for instance, public health clinics that can do pregnancy testing, referrals to prenatal care. There's also Title 10 clinics in Anchorage and in Homer that can do pregnancy tests, STI testing, referral to prenatal care, just to get things going as soon as possible in a pregnancy and make sure that that women really benefit from having longitudinal prenatal care throughout pregnancy that can take care of this and do everything we can to have a healthy pregnancy and a healthy baby.
Sure. And I understand that the laws have changed a little bit to allow expansion of prenatal care for a longer period of time for mothers, at least that qualify for Medicaid, right?
Right. So Medicaid has slightly different eligibility criteria for women who are pregnant during pregnancy. And this used to last a few months after pregnancy, and now it lasts a whole year after pregnancy. So additional ability to qualify for Medicaid is now 12 months after pregnancy, which I think really helps out people who have higher incomes and might not otherwise qualify, who are now able to stay on the program for much longer.
Excellent. So I do have an email here. It's not a syphilis question, but it is, I think, worth taking. there's surrounding confusion related to herpes, circling back, is if there's like what is the relationship between herpes, chickenpox, cold sores, and shingles? I know that's a hard question, but they are all related. So Dr. Olson, could you kind of tease out the relationship between those?
Yeah, I'm happy to. So I think we're talking about a couple different viruses here, and these are, there's some similarities. So there's one virus called varicella zoster virus. And so varicella zoster virus is a very common virus that causes chickenpox and also causes shingles. Shingles, and here's where it gets confusing, is also known as herpes zoster. And so herpes zoster is shingles, and it's not the sexually transmitted infection that we call herpes, which I'll get to in a second. So it can cause, as many of you may remember from having chickenpox, cause red, painful, itchy spots, and then shingles can cause, very painful red rash. So that's something different. And remember, we have vaccines that protect against chickenpox and vaccines that protect against shingles. And so for children, I'd recommend, making sure that you're up on your chickenpox shots. For adults over 65, I would recommend making sure you're up on your shingles vaccines to prevent varicella zoster virus. So then there's the herpes viruses. And this is what causes the sexually transmitted viruses. And there's two types, HSV, so herpes simplex virus 1, herpes simplex virus 2. And some people will simplify these as, cold sore viruses, which are commonly transmitted by kissing and can cause a sore next to your lip, for instance, or a sexually transmitted HSV 2, which people often have lesions elsewhere. But really, and this is tricky, you can't necessarily separate them like that. Both can cause sores in different locations. And so there's a lot more overlap there than being able to kind of simplify those out. So herpes can cause cold sores, and it can also cause sores elsewhere. And that's kind of that group of viruses. And so that's a different virus than the varicella zoster, which causes chickenpox and shingles.
Perfect. Thanks for teasing that out.
Hope that answers your question.
Yeah. No, absolutely. It's a good email. So we have only about 3 minutes left. I want to just circle back on testing resources, communication. James, in about a minute or so, are you able to kind of let people know in the Southeast area where they can get testing? And then we'll close it out with you, Dr. Olson, in the rest of the state.
Sure. In all three of our offices, we offer free rapid HIV tests on site and at occasional outreach events in the community. So the best way to find out about how to get to our office for that is our website, alaskanaids.org. You can also order a free STI and HIV test kit sponsored by Johns Hopkins University. The website for that is iwantthekit.org, and that will give you an at-home STI and HIV test kit, which is a great resource. There are also over-the-counter and mail-order tests available through various programs in the state, in particular with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium and SEARCH. Throughout the state, and those are our best resources right now.
Great. Well, thank you for that. And Dr. Olson, with our last minute or so, any closing thoughts and ideas about where people can get testing?
Yeah, so I would just encourage sexually active people to be tested for syphilis, other STIs, especially with a new sexual partner or with multiple partners, just thinking about getting tested regularly. Syphilis can be tested from a blood test. Some clinics offer rapid testing as well, where you can just get a finger poke and then get, and some even offer getting treated in the same visit if you have it. But I think the key is really, contacting your regular healthcare provider if you have one, get the syphilis test added on to the next blood test you do. I do that very commonly for my patients. And then for anybody who doesn't have a regular healthcare provider, there's public health centers and Title X clinics that are available across Alaska that provide low cost or free STI testing, pregnancy testing, referrals for prenatal care and other health services. So I would go ahead and look up where the public health center is in your community and see if they have some services that might be helpful for you.
That's great. That's great. I think it's an important resource that's provided. And so many times it's free. It's free care. And just the knowledge and the education that comes along with it is worth tracking these tests down. So I want to thank you guys both for being with us today. Dr. Liz Olson and James Hoagland. Thanks to our audio engineer, Chris Hyde, and our producer, Madeline Rose. You can find out more information on this and previous programs on our website at alaskapublic.org. Let us know your thoughts or suggestions by emailing us at line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. Stay healthy, Alaska.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.